Morning, everyone. So I thought I was tired from Purim, but I guess a few other people are too. So just a reminder that we haven't finished, so we finished the series on... Sorry, are we ready? Yeah. Sorry, Daisy. Yeah. Just a reminder that we are finished the series on trauma, but we still have another few sessions this term. So we have today and another 2 weeks. Each week will be a different topic. I'll announce the topic of next week during the week, hopefully. So just like a few one-offs. But today I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to take ideas, concepts that we have done in the past, way back in the past, and just share with you a formula that makes up a good formula that we learn from something that we do in the Jewish calendar this time of the year. I'm going to be perfectly honest. I had a really good Purim, a very inspirational Purim, a really good Purim. So I was a bit... So yesterday wasn't the day to prepare a whole new idea, so... No, it was all under control. It was very inspirational. It was all focused, but it was good. So let me give you the context of what I'm basing this on. So in this, you know, we in shul, in synagogue, every week, we have what's called the parsha of the week, right? So that parsha of the week is interesting. It follows on... The next portion comes when the next portion comes. It's not designated to a particular time of the year. In other words, we start after Simchat Torah, we start with Bereshit, the beginning of the Torah, and we just keep going until the next Simchat Torah, right? Although, fascinatingly enough, very often the parasha of the week is connected to what's happening during that time of the year. But there are 4 weeks of the year known as the four parashiyot, the four paragraphs, which... What we do is, it's around Purim time, 2 weeks before Purim, 2 weeks after Purim, where we, in addition to the parsha of the week, we add a portion, right? That's why we take a two Torahs. We do that sometimes also if Shabbat falls out on Rosh Chodesh or whatever, but this time of the year is known, we add four paragraphs in addition to the parsha of the week. One of them, of course, the third one is this coming Shabbat. So this coming Shabbat in Shul, we take our two Torahs. First one, we read the parasha of the week, and then the second one, we add a portion. So what are they? I'll just tell you what they are, and halachically, historically, why we do it at this time of the year. But then I'm going to go into a whole other deeper level and understand what we can learn from that and create a bit of a formula. It's a thought I once heard from my uncle, actually, many, many years ago, which I'm going to develop and extrapolate a bit. So... The first one, the 2 weeks, the two of them are done before Purim. So the first one, we read about the mitzvah of machatzit ha-shekel, or half shekel. So in temple times, there was a tax, a yearly tax, where every family had to give a half a shekel. A shekel was a type of currency, an expensive currency. It was like a silver coin. This was a half a shekel that had to be given. It had to be exactly a half a shekel, not more and not less. Doesn't matter how wealthy or how poor someone was, it was always a half a shekel. And that half a shekel tax would go towards the maintenance of the ritual service in the temple, because we know that in the temple there was daily offerings, daily sacrifice. These take place every day, particularly one in the morning, one in the afternoon. And they would be purchased by the income from this half a shekel tax, right? Now, the way it worked was that it had to be in... by the beginning of Nisan, which is the month of Pesach, which is like in 2 weeks' time. In order to do that, a month before, around the beginning of the month of Adar, which is the month of Purim, they used to start announcing, they send out notices and messengers and things to get people to remind them and to urge them to start giving the half a shekel. This was in the whole of Israel, so it was a bit of a mission. There were people set up in different towns to collect it, and then it would all eventually make its way to Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. So that was how it was done. Now, today, of course, we don't have a temple, but we often do things to commemorate what happened in the temple, right? This is a famous idea that the Talmud teaches us that while we don't have a temple, we need to always remember the temple and do things in memory. So to commemorate that, on the Shabbat closest to the beginning of the month of Adar, when they used to announce the reminder to bring the half a shekel, we add that portion in the Torah to remember how the half a shekel used to be done in times of the temple. Okay, that's parsha number one. Paragraph number two is the Shabbat, always the Shabbat just before Purim, which is known as the parsha of Zachor, where we read we remember the war of Amalek. Now, Amalek was a famous war. It was the first war that happened to the Jewish people just after they left Egypt. The Amalekites were considered a very evil people, even physically, not only spiritually, which we'll explain a little bit later, but when the Jews left Egypt and they crossed the Red Sea, the neighboring nations were petrified to start up with the Jewish people. They saw what miraculous events happened to them. They saw God had saved them, God had split the sea for them, and so on, and no one was going to start up with the Jewish nation except for the arrogance of Amalek. Amalek was a nation, just a neighboring nation, and they came and attacked. And like the Talmud gives the analogy of an analogy of a hot bath where it's very, very hot and no one sort of wants to go in because it's too hot, and then someone comes and jumps in, even if they get burnt, but they've cooled it down. Basically, now it's not so scary anymore, you know, because like the lead. So this is Amalek. Amalek is like the, and then God was particularly upset about it, and he asked Moshe Rabbeinu to gather troops and fight against Amalek, and they won the war, but Amalek still existed, and then later on there was actually a mitzvah in King Saul's time, which was also incomplete, and there was a mitzvah to actually wage a war and destroy the nation of Amalek, because they were the first ones, they were the ones to cool off and to, I suppose, historically create the chain of anti-Semitism that we still suffer from today. Now, this is connected. So once a year, we have to read this portion to remember. It says Zachor, you need to remember. It's a mitzvah to remember. When do we do it? We do it specifically the Shabbat before Purim, because Purim is connected to Amalek, because Haman, the villain of Purim, was an Amalekite. That's why it's called Haman Ha'agagi. Agagi, in the time of King Saul, was the king of Amalek. Because King Saul, just to give you the brief history, King Saul was commanded by God to fight Amalek. Well, once there was a king established in the Jewish nation, he was supposed to do the mitzvah of fighting against Amalek, but he didn't finish the job. He destroyed Amalek, but he kept the king alive, which he wasn't supposed to do. And the king conceived, lived with a woman and conceived, and Haman came from that. So the Amaleks were still alive and well, and Haman then fought against the Jewish people. So that's why this portion is read just before Purim. The third one, which we read this coming Shabbat, has to do with the red heifer. It's called Parashat Parah. The cow. Parah means cow, right? So it's the mitzvah of red heifer. Now, it's a complicated mitzvah. It's a very irrational mitzvah almost, which we'll talk about. But essentially, it was the mitzvah given to the Jewish people that if we contract impurity. Now, laws of purity and impurity are very, very complex. But there is a level of impurity which a person contracts if they come into contact or in the same room as a dead body, as a corpse, right? Now, it's not so relevant nowadays because we don't have a temple. Once again, we don't have sacrificial meat. We don't have the sacred foods that we used to eat in times of the temple. Therefore, it's not that relevant in terms of if we are pure or impure. But in times of the temple, it was very relevant. You weren't permitted to go into the Beth HaMikdash, the temple. If you're impure, you weren't permitted to eat sacrificial meat. There was lots of things you couldn't do if you were impure. And there's different ways to become pure from the impurity of different types of sources of impurity, but when it comes to this particular impurity of coming into contact with the dead body, the only way to purify is through the red heifer. So red heifer was a red cow that was completely red. There wasn't even allowed to be two black hairs on it. It was very had to be completely red. There were historically 9 red heifers until the end of the Second Temple from Moses. It used to be brought as a sacrifice. It was burnt, and then the ashes mixed with spring water. It was a whole concoction, and that was sprinkled upon the person who was impure, and that's how they would become purified. So again, the only relevance of this type of impurity today, you might notice that sometimes at a funeral, a Kohen can't come in the room, right? That's also because a Kohen is not permitted to become Tameh, or to increase the impurity. And that's the only relevance we have today of that type of impurity. It's assumed that we all have that impurity because we don't have a red heifer today, but a Kohen is prohibited from adding to that. Therefore, the Kohen can't come into the same room as the, or within 4 or certain distance of a grave. And that's why the Kohanim go in a separate room, or they stand back, or whatever the case is. Right? So why do we do it? Why do we read it this Shabbat? Because in temple times, once again, we're remembering the temple times. In temple times, around this time of the year, getting closer to Pesach, there was the what we call the Paschal Lamb, right? The Korban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice, which everyone had to be involved in. But you couldn't eat the Korban Pesach if you were impure. So therefore, this was a busy time of the year when if anyone had come into contact with a dead body, they would right away go and get the services of the red heifer, and therefore they would become pure, so they should be ready for Pesach to be able to eat and partake in the Paschal Lamb. Today we don't have a Paschal Lamb. We have the shank bone and the Seder to remember the Paschal Lamb, but that's why we do it, to remember that we read the portion of Parah Aduma, the red heifer, this coming year, this coming week. And then finally, the next Shabbat after this week is the one closest to the beginning of Nisan. Nisan, of course, is the month of Pesach. It's the commemoration of when we left Egypt and became God's nation. And we read the portion called Parashat HaChodesh, which contains the very first two commandments that the Jewish people received as a nation. The first one was to establish a calendar. We were talking about the moon before, the beautiful moon on the night. That's because it's the 15th of the month. It's always the moon, the full moon. Today's the 17th, but the 16th, I mean. Around this time of the month, that's because we run the cycle according to the moon. And that mitzvah was given to the Jewish people 2 weeks before they left Egypt on the beginning of the month of Nisan. We were given the mitzvah of running the calendar the way we run the calendar, which is the lunar cycle. Right? That was the first mitzvah, and the second mitzvah was actually the mitzvah of bringing the Paschal Lamb, the Korban Pesach. Got it? Okay. That's a brief synopsis of the four portions that we read on this time of the year. Now, on the surface, these things are all very disconnected. They happen to all fall around the same time of the year, but they're not intrinsically linked, right? In other words, the half a shekel is just because it happens to be that in this month, that's when the tax was given. The Zachar about Amalek is because it's got to do with Purim, so that's what we do it now. This coming weeks and the following weeks are a bit connected because that's got to do with Pesach and preparing for the Paschal Lamb, but they're not, when we say the four paragraphs, we don't, on the surface at least, we're not actually saying that there are four connected paragraphs, which is that's four paragraphs which we happen to read around this time of the year, right? However, nothing in Judaism is by chance, as we know. And things always happen on multi-levels and multi-layers. And there are many commentaries that actually talk about the yes connection between these four portions. And in fact, the different ways and different understandings of how they actually create a continuation and create a formula. So I'm going to share with you one of those today because it's quite an important basic idea, meaning fundamental idea, I should say. And again, I heard this from my uncle. Actually, I heard it from my grandfather. I never heard it from my grandfather directly, but he heard it from my grandfather. So he told it to me once, so I'm sharing it with you, and I'm going to develop it a bit. So the basic idea begins with a discussion we have every year around Pesach time, with understanding what Pesach actually is in spiritual terms, right? Linked also with Purim. So these four portions are linked with Purim and Pesach. Because we know that Pesach is a time of freedom, right? As we know, it's a time of Exodus. As you've heard from me 1,000 times, in Judaism we don't celebrate history, we experience history. So therefore when it comes to Pesach, the idea is not to remember a story that took place 3,300 years ago of a nation that left Egypt. That's an important part of our history. But actually it's more about what we are doing. Our own freedom, our own going beyond ourselves, going out of our own comfort zone, becoming free, freeing ourselves from ourselves and so on, right? Becoming free. Free, when we talk about freedom in the Jewish context, we don't mean free to do what we want. That's actually slavery, not freedom, right? Free to be permissive is a form of slavery. When we give in to our own temptations, we give in to our own superficiality, we give in to our own indulgences and so on and so forth. Free means, true freedom is the ability to self-control, to be in control of our lives, to live lives of meaning, to live lives of purpose, to connect beyond ourselves, to connect to other people, to connect to God, and so on. And that's the true meaning of Pesach, and that's what we try and emphasize. It's really something that applies every single day of the year, but it's emphasized around Pesach time where we learn the lessons of what it means to be free. We've talked about many of these lessons before, from the cups of wine and the matzah and so on and so forth. Now, that also is connected with Purim because what's interesting is, let's highlight this for a second. Purim and Pesach have an interesting connection. I'll just share with you. So you know, Purim is in the month of Adar, right? That's the month we're in now. Now, Adar is the only month that we sometimes have two of them. You know that? In a leap year, yes. We have what's called Adar Rishon, Adar Sheni. Next year, by the way, there's two Adars again, right? So there's in a 19, the way the Jewish, talking about the Jewish calendar, Right, so it's a system of 19 years, and in every cycle of 19 years, there are 7 leap years. Primarily, the purpose is because we have a lunar cycle. It's very interesting how the Jewish calendar works. We have a lunar cycle. Our festivals, however, follow a seasonal pattern, and that's why Pesach in the land of Israel, Northern Hemisphere, is supposed to be in the spring. But of course, that doesn't work if we keep doing the lunar calendar like the Muslims do. Their Ramadan is always in a different season because they just keep going with the lunar cycle. We don't do that because we are taught that the lunar cycle and the solar cycle has to come together. And that's why our system works that the way it works, 12 months of a lunar cycle is about 11 or 12 days short of the solar cycle, right? 354 days instead of 365 days, more or less, depending on the year. So what we do is every couple of years, we add a month. And the month we add is the month of Adar, right? So we had one, so it's like every 2 or 3 years we have a leap year. Now the discussion in the Talmud is, that's great. So what happens when we have 2 Adars? Which one should have Purim, right? Which one should have Purim? So should it be the first of Adar or the second of Adar? We don't have 2 Purims, so that could be nice, but we don't. We have only 1 Purim, right? So there's a discussion because one perspective would be, well, why don't we just take the first Adar? And in fact, there's reason to say that the first Adar is actually the main one when you have 2 Adars, because the way a leap works, the way a leap year actually functions is that you're adding an extra month. So the second Adar is the extra month, right? But we don't do that, so we put Purim in the second month. Why? Because the Talmud explains, because we want it to be as close as possible to Pesach. And that's interesting. Why is that? So many reasons, but one of the concepts behind this is that because Pesach and Purim are very, very connected, because Purim is about true happiness. And true happiness actually can only be when you're truly free, in the real sense of the word. Free meaning that you're able to go beyond yourself, that you're able to grow. In fact, the word sameach in Hebrew, which is to be happy, is very similar to tzomeach. I once read in Rabbi Twersky's books. Growth, because real simcha comes when you're not trapped in yourself. Right? I mentioned this many times in the past. Haman, in fact, the Megillah, the story of Purim, which we read on Purim, tells us that Haman was extremely happy. He came out one day and he was very happy because he'd been promoted to prime minister. Everyone was bowing down to him and he was on top of the world. And as soon as he saw one old Jew, Mordechai, refused to bow down to him, his whole world fell apart. And he was dejected, he's depressed, he goes home, he chills with his family, and he's as I say in Yiddish, he's oismensch. He couldn't function anymore, right? Why? Because his happiness wasn't real happiness. It was about him, about his ego, about his pleasure, about his arrogance, about him being better than others and so on. Very, very much about himself. Haman was an incredibly trapped person within his own egocentric being. Whereas the second time it mentions happiness in the Megillah is when the Jews were finally not completely saved yet. They were given the green light to fight back. And they saw the tide turning. And the reason the tide turned was because they reconnected to God. They fasted, they prayed, and they reconnected to their core values and their godly sort of lifestyle. And they became incredibly happy. They weren't even out of the woods yet. In fact, there was still a war to be fought, and if you know the story, and things weren't so great just yet. They were saved eventually, completely, but they were happy because they had turned within to live a life of meaning and purpose, right? So that's what we know. We know from the work of Viktor Frankl the same thing, that the truth is that it's within the yearning of each human being to strive for meaning, as we've said many times. And therefore, if that doesn't happen, and we replace meaning for pleasure, there's nothing wrong with a bit of pleasure, but if that becomes a whole pursuit, then actually it breeds unhappiness rather than happiness, right? So that freedom that Pesach teaches us to be, which is... So, you know, it seems that Purim is before Pesach, but actually it's the other way around. Because the cycle of festivals, Purim is the last festival, you realize, right? The you know, just so you understand this, so Rosh Hashanah, we always call it the new year, right? So it's the new year in terms of years, but actually... It's a very complicated system, the Jewish calendar. The way the Chagim work, the way the festivals work, actually goes from Pesach to Pesach. In fact, in the Torah, there's no names for the months, you know that, right? It came later when the Jews went to Babylon. So how the months referred to in the Torah? First month, second month, third month, fourth month, until 12th month, right? So first month is not the month of Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is in the 7th month. The first month is Nisan. It's Pesach. Because that's when the cycle of Jewishness started, right? So we say that Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year because that's when creation took place. But in fact, the Jewish cycle starts from Pesach. So the way it works is Pesach is in fact the first festival and Purim is the last. Right? But they still have to be connected because that's the whole idea. The idea is that Pesach starts the process, the journey of freedom. And there's a message on freedom in every one of the festivals until we reach Purim, where you reach the ultimate happiness. I'm just giving you a bit of a crash course here and then how the calendar works. Okay. So what I want to share with you is how these four portions that I talked about before is actually a formula referring to four things that we need to do to achieve freedom and therefore to achieve happiness. And you'll see, and that's why they're connected. So how does it work? The first one is the mitzvah of a half a shekel, right? So what's a half a shekel? So it's very, we'll learn two lessons from this. These are very, very fundamental lessons. The first is the approach we have to our material success. So we know in Torah, of course, there's a mitzvah to earn a living. There's a mitzvah to try and earn and make the means and the resources and to get the resources that we need to live. And there's certainly the Torah, Jewish perspective certainly encourages success. It warns us, the Torah does warn us that some will be more successful than others. In fact, there's a verse in the Torah that encourages to give charity where it says, "Ki lo yechdal evyon," there will always be those that don't have. That's just the way the system, godly system is. We've talked about this before. It's to create a culture of kindness. So we know that the Torah's perspective, the Jewish perspective on material success is very encouraging. It actually encourages us to work and to be successful. However, what the Torah does teach us is that success is only half the story, which is why we have this mitzvah of half a shekel, right? Because it is never complete if we don't understand the meaning and the purpose of the resources that we have. And we say resources might not always mean material resources, might mean even emotional resources or cognitive resources, whatever resources we have, which different people have at different levels, it's only meaningful if we know how to use it, right? So God tells us that once a year, we need to give this tax called half a shekel to remind us, and it's a very interesting thing. It has to be half a shekel. So the half a shekel can't be like, you know, this guy says, well, I have more, I'll give more, I'm in a generous mood today. That's very good every other day of the year. But for this particular mitzvah, it's actually everyone has to give half a shekel. It doesn't matter what you have or you don't have, it's equal. Why? Because it's an equal message to each person that what we have is only half the story. It only becomes complete if we connect it to something else. And that can mean many things. It could mean understanding that we are incomplete on our own. We need the connection to other people. We need to also share with other people. What we have is incomplete unless we use it to help and support other people. That's the idea of charity and tzedakah. Also, the commentaries, the Kabbalists talk about the machatzit ha-shekel, the half a shekel being the relationship between Jew and God. So we know that we're half. As successful as we are, or as strong as we are, as great as we are, we're always incomplete unless we connect to something higher, unless we connect to our Jewishness, to our godliness, to our meaning and values in order to complete that sort of cycle. And it's only then when we come complete. And that's the message of Machzor HaShekel. So it's really step one in the whole journey towards freedom, understanding that the way we are is never enough. Not in a negative sense that we're never enough, we need to be hard on ourselves, but our potential is always more than we're born with, or we think we're born with, right? And we always have what to learn from connecting to something beyond ourselves, which is the first message, is the first ingredient to understanding what freedom is. Freedom is not to be trapped in ourselves. We are created to grow, as we've talked about many, many times. We are created to achieve and to connect to something higher than ourselves and to go beyond what we think we're capable of, right? And that feeling of halfness, that feeling of incompleteness, is something we have to live with in our entire life. Because as long as we're alive, we can always grow, right? I tell a story of there was a great master of Musar, of ethics. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he was walking home one night, very, very late, the middle of the night, and he looked through the window in the shtetl where he lived, and he looked through the window and he saw a tailor who belonged to the community in the shtetl, and he was still working at very, very late at night. So the next day he saw him and asked him, why were you so up so late? So he told him in Yiddish a beautiful thing, because, you know, they didn't have electricity in those days, so they lit candles, right? So he told Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, "Wie lang das Licht brennt, kann man sich alles verrichten," which means if the candle is still burning, we can still fix. Right? So Rasul Santa was very inspired. He gave a speech afterwards and he said, this is what he learned from the tailor. He said the tailor was his teacher. If the soul is still burning, we can still grow, we can still fix, we can still, right? However, that's not meant in the context to create a feeling of incompleteness, inadequacy, right? Because another detail of the Machatzit HaShekel is a very interesting detail. I'll share it with you. So the Machatzit HaShekel, the shekel was a currency in that time, right? So I'm not sure exactly how the currency worked in those times, but there was different types of currencies. They weren't as organized as, like, it wasn't like, you know, there's 100 cents in a dollar and then a 100, you know. It didn't work like that. So there were different forms of currency. So there was another currency called geira, a cup of coin, a geira, whatever it was, certain weight of coin. And in a shekel, there were 20 geira, right? So a shekel is a silver coin, which contained the equivalent of 20 geira, okay? Now when the Torah gives us the mitzvah of half a shekel, it says, you must give half a shekel. The Torah says, there are 20 geira to a shekel. You need to give half a shekel, which means that when you're giving this half a shekel, you're giving 10 geira. See, here's a very interesting thing, because the commentaries explain, we know that 10, different to half, 10 actually is a number of completeness. Why is a number of completeness? Because we know that, we've talked about this many times, we know that the soul is governed by 10 powers, right? The three intellectual, the chachma ben adas, and so on, seven emotions, right? We've unpacked that many, many times. So, so when you give half a shekel, there's a feeling of being half, but yet you know you're giving a 10 geira, right? And that's actually a very, very important lesson, because that combination has to always be there. Meaning the feeling of incompleteness, imperfection, only being half, should never lead to a feeling of inadequacy, and therefore I'm not worth much, and therefore I can't achieve. Right? What we get taught is, wherever we are on the journey, we have to give it all we got. We have to give it the 10. We have 10 powers, use them all. And for that moment, that's completeness. You are complete, but you're not complete at the same time. In other words, the way the spiritual exodus of Egypt works is that we celebrate achievement, we celebrate completeness. When I've taken a step beyond my comfort zone, for now, that is true freedom, that is completeness, that is all my 10 powers together, but yet I know it's not finished. There's so much more to go. Yeah, does that make sense? Okay. So that's the concept of the Machatzit HaShekel, the half a shekel. The concept is that we've always got room to grow. We always have to connect beyond us. And also, the incompleteness is connected with the things that God has given us. We learn to have gratitude for all the resources that God has granted us. And we understand that they're there not as an end in their own, but as a means to an end, as a means to a greater purpose, as a means to greater values, as a means to living a life that we can help people, support people. And like I say, everyone has what to give. We've talked about this many times. Everyone has something they can give. It might not be physical resources, but it could be intellectual, emotional, insights, whatever the case is. But we always have to know whatever God has given us, whether material or spiritual, emotional, psychological, we have to share. It's incomplete if we keep it for ourselves. It's there to go beyond ourselves and to live a life of greater meaning. So that's the first one of the four portions. The second is Zachor Amalek. Now this is an important one. So we know that Kabbalistically, the biblical wars that were fought in the time of the Chumash, the times of the Torah, they're actually not just physical wars, they represent spiritual wars, spiritual struggles, right? So, for example, the Jewish people, when they went into the land of Israel, they had to contend with the seven nations. We know that in Israel at the time, we know that the land of Israel was at the time, in biblical times, was called Eretz Canaan, the land of the Canaanites. But Canaanites were just one nation. There were seven of them. They were the main one, but there were seven nations, Canaani, Chiti, Amori, and so on. There were seven nations that lived in Israel at the time. Amalek was not one of those seven nations. Amalek was a nation just before they went into Israel, and they were the first ones to attack the Jewish people. So we find that the Torah is very different in its approach to the nation of Amalek than to the other nations. In other words, Amalek was, there's a pasuk that says, Reshit koyim Amalek. It's like they're the worst. They need to be completely destroyed, right? Whereas with the other nations that they went into Israel, there were wars. Those wars had to be won. If they didn't vacate, then the land of Israel was essentially promised to Abraham. They were just temporary there. But something that we see the world is failed to understand. But nevertheless, right, the land of Israel was always intrinsically given to the Jewish people. That was their land. And therefore, if the seven nations resisted, historically, there was a war. However, there didn't have to be a war. Which means there was a possibility of making peace with them. There was a possibility of coming to some arrangement with them and so on and so forth. In other words, the approach to the other seven nations was not as severe as the approach we have to the nation of Amalek. Why? Because they represent a spiritual struggle. And there are two different types of spiritual struggles. See, the seven nations, Kabbalistically we are taught, refer to the seven emotions that we have. Right? And we all have our struggles with our emotions, as we know. So let's take, for example, the emotion of chesed. Right? So chesed is not just kindness, but chesed is everything to do with love and connection and attraction and expansion. All these things we've explained many, many times. Now we know that we often struggle with chesed because there's good chesed and there's bad chesed, right? So temptation is chesed when we connect to the wrong things, right? We help the wrong people. Bad tolerance of evil is a form of bad chesed. But like indulgence, for example, overindulgence, over lust and all these type of things are all part of the chesed, right? So we struggle with chesed. Gevurah is the same thing. We struggle with gevurah. Gevurah can often be very bad. Aggression, anger, violence, rejection of others, hate, all these things come from gevurah, but there's also very good gevurah, right? There's, as we know, we've talked about this many, many times. There's good gevurah in terms of discipline, self-control, it's all part of gevurah. So what happens with the seven nations, which represent the seven emotions that we have, the same thing goes with all the others, is that not only they're not intrinsically bad, right? They're not intrinsically bad. They can be redeemed. In other words, they're very, very often negative and toxic the way we are born with them, right? We all have our weaknesses. We all have our dispositions of unhealthy emotional responses to what goes on around us. But that doesn't mean that those responses are intrinsically bad. They can always be channeled into something good. One of the things we've often mentioned is even the concept of jealousy, right? Jealousy is a very bad emotion. Jealousy kills. Jealousy is very, very bad for you. But it depends what kind of jealousy. There's good jealousy, the Talmud tells us, right? Depends what it's for. There's jealousy of being... What the definition of bad jealousy is two things. When you're jealous of someone's material success, and also the very, very bad manifestation of jealousy comes from a deep insecurity where it's not that you want what someone else has, you don't want them to have it. Right? That's what real jealousy is, because you want to be better, right? So it's not just about I'd like that kind of thing. I want to have more than other people kind of thing, right? Whatever it is, it can mean anything. But the Talmud also talks about really good jealousy, which is what they call the jealousy of the wise increases wisdom. When I see someone that is wise and I aspire, it's ambition, it's healthy ambition. Healthy ambition is a form of good jealousy where I see someone succeeding in their studies or in their character traits or in their personal development and I aspire to be like that. I'm jealous of them, meaning I'm jealous of them in a good sense where I want to be like that too. Not that I don't want them to be like that, I do want them, but I also want to learn from that, right? And it's more in the context of values or things that sort of are more meaningful. So all of these, and jealousy comes also one of the seven emotions, therefore all of these things can be redeemed. Except for Amalek. Why? Because Amalek doesn't represent just another emotion. Amalek is the driver of all evil emotions. Okay? So I think I've given you this analogy once before, but if you take a car, so a car drives, is a car good or bad? Well, it depends how you drive it and where you drive it to. It's very simple, right? It's a neutral machine. If you drive to something good, to do something meaningful or helpful, then it's and you drive safely, if you're a good driver and you have a license and you know what to do and know where to stop at a red light, then it's good. If you're a delinquent driver and you
But you get in there, and also you're doing some good thing. You're pursuing someone. You're overtaking. You're speeding, or you're going to harm someone. Then it's bad, right? So in other words, a car. I'm just giving you a very simplistic analogy, but it's good to bring out the point. A car is a neutral machine. It can be used for good or for bad, depending on who's driving it, right? So often the problem is not the thing itself, it's the driver. So Amalek represents the driver of all bad emotions. What's the driver of temptation? What's the driver of jealousy? What's the driver of violence? And there's one thing that's the driver of all of this. It's ego. That's what it is, ego. Yeah.
When you say the seven nations, the first seven emotions, and Amalek is the eighth nation at this time?
Right, yes. Yeah. So Amalek is not part of the seven, but it's the source of the seven.
They were around the
same. Yeah, but they didn't live in...
Of all negative
emotions.
Okay. And then you're saying that Amalek is really ego, Yetzer
Hara, right? Right. So ego. In other words, really, if you look at the difference between a good emotional response and a bad emotional response, it boils down to one very simple thing. A bad emotional response is self-serving. It's what makes me feel good now. Pursuit of pleasure, pursuit of self-benefit, self-preservation. All bad emotions come from the same thing. What's jealousy? Jealousy is about me. It's more than Yetzer Hara. It's the ego behind the Yetzer.
Ego behind it.
Right.
Oh, okay, fine. All right.
It's the egocentricity, the ego of a person.
And then, like, you say that Amalek as a evil force in the world is like the ego of the world.
The ego of the human being. We all have our own Amalek.
Okay. And then within the nation.
Yes, that was like, because historically that was what it was. It was the arrogance of starting up with the Jewish people where no one else would.
Okay.
Right. Now we're talking about more the Amalek. When we listen to Zahar, it's more about dealing with our own Amalek, really, than they're right. That's what it is. The driver of every negative emotion is about ego. It's self-serving, what makes me feel good now. If someone says to me something I don't like and I explode, that's my ego. Because they hurt me. And how dare you hurt me? Which could be expressed itself in a insecurity, but insecurity is part of ego also, as we've talked about many times, right? Humility comes from inner strength that I'm not the whole world. I don't have to protect my fragile self every minute of the day, right? And we all have an ego, and we're all born with an ego. Now we know this is one of the great themes of Pesach. That's the idea between matzah and chametz, right? That matzah is doesn't rise, which means we get rid of the ego. That's the concept, because freedom is impossible. Personal freedom is really not possible unless we eradicate the ego. So leading up to Pesach, that's why it's the second. So the first ingredient is that we're incomplete. We have to connect higher than ourselves. But to connect higher than ourselves, which is like the half a shekel concept, we can't do that if we don't work on our ego. Now when I say take care of our ego, none of us are going to get rid of our ego anytime soon. But we can minimize it, we can work with it, we can acknowledge that it's there and try, because we all have a bit of an ego, and the ego's going to stay there until our soul returns to God, because that's what life is. Life is about struggling with the ego, right?
But it's not about becoming a schmatterie.
No, as we said. You see, no, completely not. On the contrary. It's about not taking ourselves so seriously. And also it's about, I mean, if we want to take it a little bit deeper, from a mystical Hasidic point of view, the idea of getting rid of the ego means that we're actually not independent self, we're part of a much bigger reality. In fact, when we get rid of the ego, we become stronger, not weaker. What I mean by that is, because how do you actually get rid of the ego? Truth is, from a Jewish point of view, the only way to get rid of the ego is to understand that we didn't make ourselves. Everything we have is from God. And our whole existence is God-centered and God-dependent. So what's our real existence? Our real existence is not us. Our real existence is that we're part of God's reality. If you're part of God's reality, you don't have to protect yourself so much. You're not so weak. You have plenty of room for others. You don't become diminished. See, if you made yourself, so to speak, figuratively speaking, then you've got to protect yourself, because you're just like a dot on the whole. So then someone else tries to do something, then I get threatened, right? But if I understand that all that I have is from God, it's a gift from God, it doesn't make me better or worse than other people, and we all have our own talents and strengths, it's all God-given, and that's our true reality is a godly reality, then why do I have to fight for my existence? First of all, it means that what I have is what I'm meant to have. I don't become worse or better because I have more or less than you. It all falls into place. And in fact, it's a much stronger existence. You can do much more. You're part of God's reality. You're more infinite. It's just not you all the time. It's not about proving yourself. It's about being strong and being good. Now, in terms of being a shmata, no, actually it gives you strength. It also gives you the ability to make room for other people. So often, and this is also a misunderstood concept, especially today. It does mean putting ourselves to a side a lot of the time, but not as a weakness, as a strength. See, sometimes people say yes, or they put other people first as a weakness because of the ego, because they want to look like a nice person and so on, right? In Judaism, we put other people first very, very strongly, but as a strength, not as a weakness, because it's the right thing to do, not because I'm a shmata. I can say no if I want to, but I don't have to. In fact, I try to look out for others as much as I can, without diminishing myself, without destroying myself. Obviously, we have to take care of ourselves and so on, but it comes from a strength. I give from a strength, not from a weakness. Yeah, does that make sense? Yeah, okay. All right, so that's the second portion that we read in these four portions, because that's without that, we can't achieve freedom. The third one is very interesting. The third one is this, and it links to the ego as well. It's this coming week, which is the portion of Paraduma. Now we're running out of time a little bit, so let me explain this briefly. Paraduma is the red heifer. So the red heifer is, we know that in the Torah there are different kinds of mitzvot, right? We know there's 630 mitzvot in the Torah. Many of them we don't practically do today because we don't have a temple and so on. But essentially, there's a formula. Now, in those mitzvot, they divided into three parts, really. But for this conversation, it's good enough to say they're divided into two parts: the ones that make sense, the ones that don't make sense, by design, right? Meaning the ones that we know the reason, the ones we don't know the reason, or the reason is beyond us, right? So to give an example, so Pesach, it makes sense, you know. We went out of Egypt, we ate matzah, the bread didn't rise, so we eat matzah. Honoring our parents, society can't function without that. Not stealing, not killing, basic decency, basic human decency, basic society structure, something society cannot exist without that. And there are many, many mitzvot, either they have logical reasons, or the reasons maybe we wouldn't have figured out ourselves, but they become explained to us. The mitzvah of putting on tefillin, mezuzah, they're all part of those mitzvot. But then there's a body of mitzvot in the Torah, as we know, which are called chukim, which actually don't have a reason. They're actually not explained. There are concepts behind them, there are mystical ideas behind them, but they essentially don't know the reason. Of those chukim, of those mitzvot, the greatest one, the one that makes least sense, is this red heifer thing. Why do I say this? Because it says in the Tanakh, like King Solomon, who was called the wisest of all men, said that he was able to work out the reasons even for the ones that don't make sense, except for Paraduma. The way purity comes, we don't know. The way impurity goes, we don't know. It's all metaphysical stuff. It makes no sense to us. What does purity mean? What does impurity mean? What does a cow have to do with making you pure, impure? The whole thing is just beyond us, right? Together with a string of other mitzvot that don't make sense, but this is the prototype. This is the real chok of the Torah. This is the one that doesn't make sense. So why do we keep it? Because it doesn't make sense. That's why we keep it. What do I mean? Because God gave us two kinds of mitzvot for a reason. On the one hand, understanding things is very important. Because understanding things means that you internalize it, becomes part of you. And you keep it and you connect to it with every part of yourself, right? In other words, when someone tells you to do something that you don't like to do or you don't understand why you should do it, you're doing it with your hands. You're not doing it with your mind, your soul, your passion, right? I always give this analogy, like it's asking a teenager to clean up their room, right? Even if they comply, but they're just doing it with their hands because they just see no reason why it's important. Okay? So they listen, they do it, but it's not the whole of them that's doing it. It's just their hands that are doing it, right? Whereas, so that's why God said, we are the people of the book. But God says, you've got to learn, you've got to understand. You've got to understand the depth of the mitzvot. You've got to understand the depth of what it means to be Jewish. You've got to, you know, we once did this course where we took a whole bunch of things that everyone knew the basic reason of kindergarten, that we try to explain it and advance it further because that's what we're supposed to do. Because then we have a whole other look on it. When we put up a mezuzah, we know the meaning behind it is different, right? Shabbat experience, kashrut, all these things, not kashrut so much actually, but all these things are so different when we learn about them, we understand about them. That's what the Talmud says. Before a festival, for example, you're supposed to 30 days, you're supposed to study, right? You know, this afternoon I'm going to put back my Purim books, take out the Pesach ones, because you want to learn, you want to understand, you want to come to Pesach, meaning knowing something, right? And understanding depth. That's all important. But there's a downside to having to understand everything. And the downside is we have to understand everything that we never surrender to something beyond ourselves. And one of the most important things, again, when we talk about putting aside the ego, is to know that as much as we can understand, we are extremely limited. We think we're very smart. We think we're unbelievable, but we're nothing at the end of the day. The human intellect is extremely finite. Extremely. Especially in comparison to if we believe in a God. God is infinite. God is undefined. God sees things that we can never even contemplate or entertain to be understanding. Right? So part of the journey of growth, and this is something which is so important today, because today the societal feeling is the exact opposite. It's about what I understand, my reality, my this, my that, my authenticity, as they call it nowadays, my truth, my this, my everything's my, right? And people are very averse today to doing anything that doesn't sit well with them. And Judaism teaches us exactly the opposite. That if you want to lead up to Pesach, if you want to lead up to freedom, one of the things you have to read is the story of the red cow. Because you have to be ready. You have to always understand what you could understand, but you also have to be ready to submit and to surrender. Kashrut is like that, by the way. As I've often told you, there's no reason for kashrut. It's not because of health reasons, because a schmaltz herring is very unhealthy and it's perfectly kosher. Right? In excess, at least. Tastes good, exactly. Right? So yeah, while there are all sorts of explanations about meat and milk and chesed and gevurah, that's Kabbalistic ideas, but and they hinted, but it's not. We don't know the real reason. So why do we keep it? Because we surrender, and that's a very healthy and important part of the Jewish journey. Shabbat is different. Shabbat is explained. Shabbat has lots and lots of meaning to it. Mezuzah, Tefillin, lots of Purim, Pesach. They are understandable mitzvot and have so much depth behind them. But there's certain things that God gives us. We have to understand our limitation. Because growth can only come when you know that there's a whole world beyond you. And especially in a Jewish context, not only there's a world beyond you in terms of other people, which we might be able to learn from, but particularly with regard to a godly force, which is way beyond us, infinitely beyond us, and that's why it's so important as part of the growth, part of the journey of achieving freedom. And the last one I'll just mention briefly, there's a couple of ideas, but I'll just mention one, is the fourth parasha we read, which is the... It's very interesting, at the very, very first mitzvah that was given to the Jewish people is the calendar. First mitzvah.
The calendar.
To make the calendar. It's the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, the mitzvah of having the first day of the month and to make the calendar, to be aware of the calendar, time. It's an amazing thing, by the way, you know that in Jewish observance, there's an incredible awareness of time. That? First of all, the months, like you said, the full moon. So I thought right away, because the full moon, I can tell you the next full moon is going to be, and maybe not as big as the one you saw, but it's the next 15th of the month. Every 15th, because we're aware, because we know when Rosh Chodesh is, on the 15th of the month is the full moon, right? Even every day, we're so aware of time. If I met a random guy on the street and I said, you know what time sunset is today? Look at me, so I'm crazy. Sugar, what do you care about the sunset? But as Jewish people, we're very, very worried about the sunset. I need to know, I can only daven mincha till a certain time. The evening prayer has to be at sunset. Shabbos begins at sunset, it ends when the stars come out. Yeah, right? There's a whole body of, it's a credible thing, there's a whole body of knowledge that is surrounding the consciousness and awareness of time in Jewish practice, the most fascinating thing, right? Like, I grew up that way and I take it for granted, but I never only when I start thinking about it, like, I wonder what other people think when you're sort of worrying about when sunset, when's dawn, when's dusk. Like, yes, a few days ago there was a fast day. Right, so you look it up. When is the fast day? When is the fast start? By dawn, 5:23. So I knew I'd get up at 5 o'clock for a coffee. Right, so which I did. It's fantastic when you get up before the fast. If it's a day fast, that is, right. You get a coffee. It's a different fast. It's fantastic. But all these things, amazing. Why? It's the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people: the value of time. Because when we talk about living a life of values, it's not just about doing things that are good; it's making sure that every day counts. Like, I can't say I'm going to live half a week with values, because then the other half a week is a waste of time, right? Even if I've done amazing things on Tuesday, but Wednesday's another day. Because one of the most fundamental things in Judaism is, and in terms of our growth pattern and how we grow and become intrinsically free, is that every day is a new day. Every day is a gift. We wake up in the morning, we say Mode Ani, we thank God for returning our soul, it's a gift. What happened yesterday, what happened yesterday, but now it's a gift, which means I have to make this day count. What am I doing to make, to allow myself to grow today? What am I doing to make this day meaningful and valuable? And that's why the first mitzvah that was given to the Jewish people is time, the calendar. You've got to elevate time, you've got to sanctify time. Because sanctified time means making every single day a meaningful one. So those are the four portions that on the surface are not really connected, but they are, because they're all about a formula that allows us to prepare for Pesach and understand and internalize the concept of intrinsic freedom. And that's why we have this concept of the half a shekel, getting rid of our ego, the idea of surrendering something beyond us and making every day count. Okay, another 2 weeks of this, and we'll do different topics. I'll let another topic is, and have a wonderful day.